It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a federal law that bans firearm ownership for those who have a domestic violence restraining order against them.
The 8-1 United States versus Rahimi decision overturns a circuit court ruling that the federal law was unconstitutional.
The case has been watched closely by groups on different sides of firearm regulation debates and by groups that work on domestic violence issues.
Here in Wisconsin, a similar state law remains in effect alongside the federal law, but our next guests say the federal court ruling was still important here in the state.
Monique Minkins is Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
And Jenna Gormel is Public Policy Director for End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Jenna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Monique, big picture, how significant is this U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding that federal law? I know you've had your eye on that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big deal. That's the best way I can explain it. It's a big deal. We talk about VAWA and how it was to keep people safe in the streets and in the home. And this is one of those measures that will ensure that happens. It protects people, especially when I think about, or not when I think about, but individuals who have sought a restraining order, have a temporary restraining order, it protects them because that's the police contact with the person, with the harm doer. And so we're really excited. I am kind of tongue-tied, but we were really excited when we saw that, because it is a step, it is a support for victims and survivors that is really important, considering, according to our 2022 homicide report, 88.5% of DV homicides were with a firearm. Mm. And so it is really big.
Jenna, this was a federal court ruling in a different circuit. Wisconsin has a similar law on the books that at least with this ruling was not in danger. Can you talk about the state laws in Wisconsin and how they work when it comes to firearms and domestic violence restraining orders?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as you said, the decision wouldn't have overturned our state laws that prohibit access to firearms. But, you know, so our Wisconsin laws would have remained intact. So that is, you know, we always knew that. However, our primary concern was that if the federal law were to be found unconstitutional, it would be one less avenue to protecting survivors. And also, our primary concern actually was that it would open the door for more challenges to our gun laws. And we saw other states experiencing firearm surrender law state-level challenges, which meant that in many parts of those states, the state-level case was being cited as a reason to not enter orders to surrender weapons, even in civil proceedings where the burden of proof or like the preponderance of evidence is technically lower. So we're lucky in Wisconsin that we have those protections, but anything that happens federally, we've seen this all across different states where there will be, it kind of opens the door to further legal challenges.
Monique, you had mentioned the preponderance of domestic violence deaths in Wisconsin being related to guns. Also, the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence reports that women are 5 times more likely to be killed when their abuser has access to a gun. How effective are laws like these at protecting people from becoming victims of domestic violence?
I think they're very effective. It sets a parameter and some boundaries for victims and survivors. I also want to add, though, this is in our state, we still have this loophole that needs to be closed, because it supports people if they are a spouse, if they live in a home or live in a home together for a considerable amount of time, or have a child together. And so if it's a boyfriend, like teen dating violence, or even adults, it doesn't they kind of slip through the cracks. And so it's important, and I do believe there's more work to be done.
speaking of loopholes, another issue some people have been working on, and this came before the state Supreme Court, Jenna, a law related to disorderly conduct exceptions when it comes to gun restraining orders. In some cases, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, something that we would logically consider to be domestic violence, if someone makes a plea or is only charged with disorderly conduct, the restraining order gun law doesn't come into effect. Do I have that right?
You do, yes. That's the misdemeanor law. So again, yeah, closing those dangerous loopholes. We do have a dangerous loophole in the state that allows misdemeanor domestic violence offenders to own guns. So under federal law, but not state law, a person who's been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence may not possess a firearm, which means that current state law allows those convicted of a misdemeanor crime involving domestic violence to own firearms. And last session, there was a bill that reorganized two statutes. And again, this is, it really comes down to technical language in the statute. But we introduced the bill last session. Unfortunately, it did not pass. And what that would do was reorganize two statutes, which is the crime of disorderly conduct and the definition of domestic abuse, so that individuals convicted of disorderly conduct with a domestic violence are prohibited from possessing a firearm. And unfortunately, that did not pass last session. But we do plan to introduce that again next session in January. But that is a dangerous loophole that is currently in effect in the state.
We're talking about last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding a federal law that allows guns to be taken away from people who have restraining orders for domestic violence. Monique Minkins and Jenna Gormel are with us from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique, for advocates like your organization, these laws aren't just about preventing fatalities, as I understand it. What role do firearms play in keeping victims of domestic violence in unsafe situations?
It goes without saying that it keeps victims and it keeps people safe. It's greater than, I think about how this is a community issue where domestic violence often spills into the streets as well. And so, for example, in the case that the Supreme Court decided upon, the gentleman forced his girlfriend into the car, and then he shot at a bystander. And so it's about the whole community and keeping the whole community safe. And this person had lots of touches with law enforcement. And so this is where we start talking about common sense gun laws. Where there are some people that just have no business having a gun because they have this history of doing harm or causing concerns in the community.
Jenna, can you talk about how a restraining order happens in the first place? How difficult is it for someone to get that restraining order in place and how that's enforced?
Yeah, absolutely. So luckily, we work with advocates all across the state in domestic violence organizations who can support survivors with accessing a domestic violence restraining order. It does require that you go to court. So you have to file paperwork. You have to go in front of a judge and potentially ask questions about your petition. You know, if a judge then grants you a final domestic abuse injunction, they have to order the abuser to hand over any firearms in their possession. And so there is a removal process that was established in 2014. But, you know, going to court, you're having to, you know, explain your story. You need to provide, there is a burden of proof, right? So you have to provide evidence. And you, when you go to court, you're in front of the abuser as well. So it can be a difficult process. And we always encourage survivors, if they are seeking this process, to definitely reach out to their local domestic violence programs. And we can see if we can get you some assistance, because just having someone there alongside you can be incredibly helpful.
Monique, in our last few moments, is there something that people you think misunderstand when it comes to the subject of domestic violence?
I think, and thinking about the gun laws, there's always that question of why doesn't the person leave? And most of the time, a person is in more danger when they leave. In this case, this woman was leaving. In the majority of our 2022 homicides, the person was leaving. And so it's greater than the physical harm. There are also the underlying pieces of equity and how people are treated when they go and receive a restraining order. Sometimes people from underrepresented populations don't have great experiences. It's about health equity. It's about economic equity, where lots of times people rely on their harm doers for financial support. And so there are the things that we see and that we know based on what you hear on TV and the news. And there are these underlying pieces that we can't ignore. And lots of times when systems work together and in tandem, you have better results. You have liberated people instead of these Band-Aids. And so that would be what I think is a misunderstanding or something that a connection that's not often made.
We'll leave it there. Monique, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jenna, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
That was Monique Minkins and Jenna Gormel with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We talked about a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding a federal law that prohibits gun ownership for people with a domestic violence restraining order against them.
Our June member drive is Thursday, and it's only one day long.
That means it's crunch time for a special challenge we have going. When 500 people donate before Thursday, a group of generous members will donate an extra $10,000 for WPR programs.
Make your gift to WPR early and help us meet that goal. Your donation helps fund Wisconsin Today and all the programs you rely on. So give now at WPR.org/donate. And thank you so much for your support.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new book examines the long and complicated relationship between news media and police and the control of information.
What types of access are journalists losing?
A look at the friction between police and the press and what it means now. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Both Republican Party and Democratic Party officials are planning for protests during their conventions this summer. At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee next month, journalists will file their stories as police patrol the biggest political event of the election cycle.
A new book examines the long and complicated relationship between the police and press in the United States, with periods of coexistence and at other times open hostility, like after the murder of George Floyd in 2020.
Scott Memel is the author of Pressing the Police and Policing the Press, The History and Law of the U.S. Press-Police Relationship. He's an adjunct professor in the Dietrich College of Communication at Marquette University. Scott, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the Republican National Convention. Multiple law enforcement agencies involved in securing the convention next month, U.S. Secret Service as well. And it requires major coordination and media access and credentialing. What might relations be like between journalists and police?
Great question. And, you know, it's always topical because whenever police are around, often there's going to be journalists and sometimes vice versa. So what I found throughout my studies is that there's two major types of interactions between the press and the police. There's ones that I call cooperative coexistence, right, where either they're cooperating together in some way or they're just able to coexist. You know, the reporter's doing their job, the police officer, they're doing their job, and there's just, you know, there's no major issues there. On the flip side, though, there can be moments of contentiousness. So if the press is holding law enforcement accountable in some way, that can lead to some contentiousness. Or also, vice versa, if law enforcement targets the press with, you know, an arrest of some kind, some violence, a threat, anything along those lines, that's going to make it contentious too. And so it's just kind of a wait and see game, unfortunately, of any of those are possibilities. We've seen in the past, DNCs, RNCs have led to some pretty violent confrontations between the press and the police, including 1968 in Chicago, a very noteworthy moment. And so we just have to wait and see which of those categories will reign supreme, potentially both, potentially one more than the other. We'll wait and see.
Well, let's take us to 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And you point out that journalists are being arrested for trying to cover protests, and journalists felt like they couldn't trust police. The public felt like they couldn't trust journalists. What did this distrust stem from?
It's a fascinating moment in many ways, because up until this point, we're talking obviously civil rights era, you've got two institutions that are made up predominantly of white men. So you got law enforcement historically, predominantly white men, not entirely, you know, I don't want to paint in too broad of brushes here, but again, you know, overgeneralizations here. Same with journalism as well. And very much these two institutions, especially when we're talking about the 1920s to 1950s, that was an era across the United States of great partnerships between these two sides. And there's a whole variety of reasons for it, but one of which is it's white men dealing with white men, and there's friendships there. There's just an understanding of we'll help you out if you help us out, and we can have these partnerships, again, without that contentiousness that I talked about. Well, then something happens where you just have the kind of the chaos of these protests happening in Chicago. And all of a sudden, law enforcement start tackling reporters and journalists. They start targeting them with tear gas and, you know, other chemical agents. And the press is going, whoa, what happened here, right? I thought we were good, so to speak. And it was just a moment where it was a bit of a wake-up call for journalists and for protesters alike that law enforcement violence, they're not immune to it. And so we've seen, you know, the George Floyd protests. We could go through many other examples as well that those same trends have certainly continued. And with the key being, it wasn't brand new, though, either in 1968. As I trace in the book, we can go back, you know, all the way to the American colonies and see violence against the press by law enforcement. But as you asked in your question, it's just this key moment of division where the press for the first time is going, well, hold on a second. Maybe we don't have the symbiotic relationship we thought we had with police. And then other factors come into play as well.
Taking us then to 2020 and police and press interactions surrounding the murder of George Floyd, you put out the statistic 131 journalists were arrested in 2020 while they were reporting on the protests that rose up around Floyd. Why are journalists being arrested?
Well, I think there's probably a few factors in play, right? We're talking about chaotic scenes where, and this is where we can give some deference to law enforcement, right? There's a lot going on, you know, just chaotic scenes where it's just a lot of people, a lot of crowds. And, you know, when you start to get forms of violence, when the protests start to get a little more violent for whatever reason that may be, it's going to put some extra pressure on law enforcement, obviously. Now, at the same time, we can also be critical of law enforcement, too. And we can also say these are credentialed journalists. They were wearing their credentials. They identified themselves as members of the press. They're there to do their jobs, too. And the key is there's some really important messages, you know, racial justice messages coming out of these protests. And the press is there to make sure that those messages are amplified and heard, right, to inform the public. And at the same time, holding law enforcement and government accountable as they're responding to these protests. And so you take kind of a combination of kind of a chaotic scene with law enforcement perhaps overstepping their bounds, not recognizing that these are members of the press, not taking a step back and learning, hey, that's a credentialed member of the media. And you get kind of a perfect storm that we saw not only in Minneapolis, certainly, but also across the United States.
Scott, did the events surrounding George Floyd's death lead to changes in how the press and police carry out their work now?
It certainly has led to reflection. My hope is that in my book, I make some recommendations how to improve the press-police relationship. I'm hope I can be part of those conversations, but at the very least, there's been some reflection in terms of, okay, as a law enforcement agency, how do we work with the press, but also vice versa. I teach media ethics at Marquette University, and it's a big question of how do we cover police? How are we critical of law enforcement? How do we make sure that we're acting in an ethical manner while making sure we're reporting the truth and all those key sorts of media ethics elements that we've all heard of before in different ways. And so I think there's been that reflection. In terms of tangible steps that have been made, that's where you'd have to look more at the department-by-department level. You'd also look at, FBI, statewide police forces like the Minnesota State Patrol. There's been litigation that's come down kind of through that's led to settlements in different cases between cities and journalists who are harmed during these. So certainly there's those types of tangible things that have come out. But more than anything, as I highlight in the book, it's just a greater awareness that, okay, this relationship obviously exists. There was a moment here of really serious contentiousness. So what does that mean for us now going forward? And hard to believe, but now 4 years after the fact, how do we still keep reflecting on those events and try and minimize that to the greatest extent possible?
We have Scott Memel with us, new book, Pressing the Police and Policing the Press. Memel is an adjunct professor at Marquette University in its College of Communication. You write about impersonations as a type of this contentious interaction between press and police. What are these impersonations like?
Yeah, it's really a fascinating part of the history of this relationship where, just to make sure we're all on the same page, a journalist is going to pretend to be a police officer or some member of law enforcement, and then vice versa. A member of law enforcement is going to pretend to be a member of the press, a journalist of some kind. And it's fascinating all the different ways that this happens. I mean, you get cases where police officers are dressing up as close to a reporter as they can, right? They've got their notepad, they're taking notes. Some even have had cameras before. To be fair, police have been exposed sometimes when a professional journalist will be looking at them and going, well, they're holding their notepad, but they're not taking any notes. Or, well, the camera's not even on and they're pointing it to the scene right now. There's all these different ways that it happens. Journalists do the same deal where it's a little bit more rare because it's illegal, obviously, to impersonate a police officer. It's not illegal to impersonate a journalist, at least when we're talking about state and federal statutes. But it's unique. There's a number of ways that they're trying to blend in for any number of purposes. For law enforcement, it may be to end a standoff or a hostage situation. In some cases, it may be to investigate someone, so they need to blend in. And if you're acting like a journalist, someone may talk to you, right? And then for journalists, the same deal. Pretend to be a police officer, that may give you access you otherwise don't have. Of course, from that comes a lot of negative effects as you're kind of blurring these lines and just adding again more contentiousness to this relationship.
And in blurring those lines, the Central Intelligence Agency, you write about the 70s, that agents had been impersonating American journalists for decades. What have been the effects of that? And what was going on there in the CIA?
Yeah, so it became this very secretive but well-established practice. CIA personnel around the world would impersonate journalists or media organizations, sometimes with their blessing and sometimes not with their blessing, for any number of purposes around the globe. And you can imagine, we're talking about World War II, we're talking about the beginning of the Cold War. So obviously, a lot going on in the international context around this time. And even to the point that the CIA had training programs of how to act like a journalist, how to sound like a journalist.
Wow.
Pretty fascinating, some of what's going on there. And so what are the ramifications from this? There are several, but ultimately it comes down to you're undermining the independence of these institutions, especially the press. Under the First Amendment, the whole idea is the press is meant to serve all of us as members of the public, almost like a fourth branch of government, but of course not, but as an independent or an independent group where there isn't something where you have to be licensed to be a journalist, where there is this independence as an institution. an institutionalization that started in the early 1900s, really saying, okay, we want to draw boundaries around ourselves as journalists, as an institution, like in the sciences, like law enforcement was doing literally at the exact same time during the progressive era. So the problem is when you undermine that independence, you're undermining journalists' credibility, because now, you know, I think we could all relate to this. You're not going to talk to someone if you're not sure they're a journalist. If you think they're a police officer, you're probably going to not be as willing to divulge your secrets or whatever information you may have. So credibility is at risk. News gathering is at risk. And on top of all of that, just making it harder for journalists to do their jobs. Again, it's adding a level of contentiousness because you're not going to be a happy individual if you're a journalist and all your sources all of a sudden aren't talking to you anymore because they think you may be a police officer.
I want to bring up these media ride-alongs that you write about.
Yeah.
And New Year's Eve, 1925, a reporter for the Kenosha Evening News does a ride-along with an officer and is even you write about even driving the police car. What were the purposes of media ride-alongs and what does that do to the press-police relationship?
Yeah. Another fascinating part of the relationship, to be fair, with a lot of very similar effects where, you know, you've got this blurring of the lines between these institutions and it's going to undermine independence. It's going to, quite frankly, just make it harder for each to do their jobs properly. Because you've got police officers, if you've got a camera pointed at you, guess what? You're probably going to do your job a little differently, right? And by the same token, if you're a journalist and you're writing with a police officer, it can be pretty hard to be critical of them, right? Because you're going to lose that access. They're not going to be happy with you. You know, it's harder to hold the police accountable as a result. These are effects that date back, I found, to the 1880s, when you see the very first examples of, and I use the term vehicles loosely here, but the very first police vehicles. These were horse-drawn wagons that there are antecedents that there were horse-drawn wagons that were dedicated for firefighting purposes. But then around the early 1800s, Chicago, St. Louis, a couple other cities are thinking, well, what if we had one of these horse-drawn wagons, but just for the police? So they can get to a crime scene more quickly. They can detain someone and take them down to the, you know, police station, all that sort of deal. It's the very first time that there are dedicated vehicles, again, so to speak, for police. And right away, as soon as these are created, the journalists were there to cover these new horse-drawn carriages that were fascinating to them, but also riding along, going to the crime scenes, seeing what law enforcement was doing, who they were arresting on that given day. So 1880s through the present, you know, certainly including that example, as you said, in Kenosha, 1925, a long-established practice with, again, those same types of negative effects that just make the relationship more contentious, more challenging, and just undermines the ability of the press and police to serve all of us as members of the public.
I wonder, could more training within the ranks of police or training for reporters improve how police interact with the press and vice versa? What would training look like?
I think that's absolutely part of the equation. If we're thinking about, okay, great, Scott, you've told us all about this history of this relationship. You've talked about the legal landscape. You know, so what, right? So what can we do about it? I think training is absolutely a part of the equation here. So for law enforcement, it's training in, you know, First Amendment rights, free speech, freedom of the press. How do you interact with journalists at chaotic scenes like a protest and even in just kind of your everyday? How are you working with reporters at a crime scene or a place where maybe there isn't, you know, quite as much activity going on? And by the same token, I think you're absolutely right. You know, for journalists as well, learning about media ethics, again, a course I teach at Marquette University, key question is, okay, so what are the media ethics around reporting on police? There's a lot of discussion. You look up some really great kind of research and videos online about how crime reporting can be very misleading, that because of the focus on, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, so to speak, that we all as members of the public have kind of a warped sense of just how much crime is going on in our communities. And media ethics and kind of training for journalists of how to properly report on crime and policing absolutely, that should be part of the equation as well.
And finally, public information officers, that officers on the force who are specifically trained to work with the media, how has that affected our relationship?
Yeah, so again, the fascinating part of doing kind of this long history of the U.S. press police relationship is you start to figure out, okay, where do these things start to arise? And it's really, especially in the progressive era, the early 1900s, that you start to see public relations bleeding into really many aspects of our society, but including law enforcement as well. And that's going to gain a lot of steam, especially when you get to the 1960s and the 1970s as well. Becomes very much just an accepted part of law enforcement that you would have kind of these public relations efforts. And the main problem with that is you're adding a barrier, so to speak. You know, we're talking about two separate institutions. If journalists have free access to talk to police officers, to talk to police chiefs, you know, other members of squads, you know, detectives, whatever the case may be, that's a lot of good access. That's a lot of information you can compile. When there's one individual who's kind of spearheading those efforts, and again, I'm not trying to denigrate PIOs in any way. I think, you know, they do important work, but they're often one person or at most maybe one department, where now you're running into a barrier it's a step where now you're not getting immediately to those officers, to those officials behind the lines, you know, in law enforcement. So it adds that level of barrier, which can certainly be productive for law enforcement. But the question, of course, is, what information isn't getting out? What types of access are journalists losing? Again, all with the idea that there should be that media ethics element always behind the scenes as well.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Scott Memel is an adjunct professor at Marquette University, author of the new book, Pressing the Police and Policing the Press.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new exhibit from the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project showcases remarkable people, events, and milestones from the past.
We feel it's important to get this out into the world at a time when LGBT content is being censored, being removed from libraries, being, you know, forbidden to be spoken in schools.
It's a tour called Summer to Be Seen, ahead on WPR News. Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Parrott.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pride Month is in full swing, and communities around Wisconsin celebrate LGBTQ culture and rights in different ways.
Organizers of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project are touring the state, making stops at Pride events to showcase a new exhibit. It gives more visibility to the people, places, and events that made Wisconsin's LGBTQ community what it is today.
The exhibit is called Summer to Be Seen, and it debuted at a Pride rally in Ripon and concludes in Whitewater. Michael Takosh is board chair of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. Michael, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you start by just acquainting us with the work of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project and what it encompasses?
Absolutely. So we are proud to be the state's leading authority on local LGBTQ history. Our organization was founded in 1994 as a collaboration between local researchers and the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives of Los Angeles, which is now known as the One Institute. So we chronicle, document, and preserve the hidden histories of Wisconsin in an attempt to reconnect Wisconsin with its past to inspire its future.
How did you come up with a plan to tour the state for the project's 30th anniversary?
That's an interesting one. So we have seen a massive generational shift in the past few years where the emerging generations, including Generation Z and Alpha, don't really understand the concept of Pride being a day or a weekend or an event or even a month, because this is just who they are every day. They don't come out of a closet and celebrate once a year. They don't go somewhere or have to, you know, be in a gated community or a festival park to celebrate themselves. And they want to see this visibility in their hometowns, no matter where they live. They're not going to leave their community to be who they are.
And that's an important transition in LGBT history, because for centuries, our elders had to leave their small town communities to be who they were, because they couldn't live that life in their hometowns. So hearing that feedback over the years, as we had an exhibit at Pride Fest Milwaukee from 1994 to 2019, we really thought about like what's next and what makes sense. So we realized that the right thing to do was not to ask people to come to our history to enjoy and celebrate and connect to it, but to bring the history into the communities of Wisconsin, to be in the small town streets, to in those city parks, in those community centers all over the state, and really let people know, you know, we've always been here in all corners of Wisconsin. And whether or not we were seen doesn't matter, because we know we were there. And these stories prove that. And what we're also trying to do with this outreach is to source new stories. Who are the emerging leaders throughout Wisconsin? So we're really seeing this as an outreach and networking and hopefully an inspirational great awakening. I have been in Wisconsin for most of my 50 years, and I have to say, I feel like we're in a LGBT leadership crisis. There is no one unifying the masses in any direction the way that previous organizations or leaders did. And to be fair, we're in an election year, and there's a lot on stake. It's not a year for a party. It's a year for activation. It's a year for mobilization. It's a year for education. So personally, to me, being in the streets of Wisconsin and inspiring youth to vote and to take agency for their own lives and to be visible and vocal in their hometown communities, there is no greater investment we can make.
And your tour itself, with about 16 stops, that has made visible just how many events in communities all over the state are out there, celebrating Pride, celebrating LGBTQ community. What does that say about Wisconsin?
It's remarkable. So I was on the board of directors of Milwaukee Pride for 10 years. And throughout that time frame, we were aware of emerging prides around the state, but there were nowhere near as many as there are now. Within the past 5 years, literally since the pandemic, the number has more than quadrupled. There are over 40 hometown pride celebrations in Wisconsin, ranging from very small communities like Lake Pepin to very large and established communities like Duluth Superior, who host the oldest and longest running pride event in the state. Not a place you'd expect to find that, right? Hmm. I think it says that Wisconsin remembers its progressive heritage, and it wants to move back in that direction after, you know, years of being told that, you know, they were wrong. They're not going back. They're going forward. And, you know, as in alignment with the state motto, I applaud them wholeheartedly. To learn that there were so many as we were doing our outreach, our planning and our design for the tour was overwhelming, even to us. So I think that, you know, if we can bring great visibility to these hometown prides and really elevate their efforts and really build unity among them, there's an opportunity for a statewide movement and some statewide connectivity and community between organizations that might feel like they're on their own, you know, on an island, shouting at the wind. And to know that there are 39 other organizations like yours trying to achieve the same thing all over the state is powerful.
Michael Takash is with us from the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project as we talk about its Summer to Be Seen tour, exhibitions happening at local pride events around the state. Michael, what kind of questions or other feedback have you received from, you know, people coming up to this tour, this exhibition, as they experience your panel displays?
We hear tremendous positive feedback, especially from youth who can't believe that we are coming to their hometowns. They thought that they would need to drive, you know, 2 or 3 hours to a big city. And maybe that's not an option for them financially, logistically. You know, we see a lot of hometown organizers who feel the love and feel, you know, the sense of being part of something bigger. And, you know, a lot of the youth today in Wisconsin are hearing these horrible, you know, retro messages, these messages of self-destruction and judgment, attempting to isolate and destabilize them so they don't become the next generation of Wisconsin's LGBTQ leadership. And the sad part is their elders heard those same messages 50, 60, 70 years ago. And the playbook is deliberate, and the impact can be very destructive. But if we can overcome that by providing an alternative, by connecting people to history and heritage and letting them know that they have a community, and that community has always been here, and there's nothing wrong with them because they're just another member of this long lineage of people, whether they knew it or not. If we can provide that hope and that faith that the future can be better, brighter, more vibrant, more inclusive, more supportive, again, that is the value of our investment. We're a nonprofit organization. We don't charge anything for any of our services. Our website is free. Our content is free. And, that's because we feel it's important to get this out into the world at a time when LGBT content is being censored, being removed from libraries, being, forbidden to be spoken in schools around the nation. The more we can reach people in person, online, the better.
And let's tour a bit of these panels now. Ralph Kerwinio, 1876, forced to live as a woman despite identifying as a man. Can you talk a little bit about Ralph's life? I've been looking at pictures, dressed extremely stylish for the era.
Yeah, so our Ralph was a bit of a playboy. He was a two-timer. In fact, that's how he was found out in the first place. His wife found out that he was dating another woman and that he planned to marry the other woman, making him Wisconsin's first trans bigamist, perhaps. But he was picked up by the police in downtown Milwaukee under the charges that, he was in fact a she, and that he was disguising himself to deceive women and to perhaps have some untoward criminal intentions. But Ralph really had no criminal intentions. Ralph was living his best life. He was, a womanizer. He was a sportsman. He was a gambler. He was into music and fashion and art. He was really ahead of his time, and he was living large. And unfortunately, after being found out, he was ordered to return to the life of a woman that he never was. And this misgendering and this, attempt to shame him really didn't work, because there's news reports that he returned to being Ralph and, was caught in, in cahoots with other women over the next few years. So it just goes to show that the idea of trans identity, the idea that gender is expansive and not a binary, is not a new idea. It's not a modern invention. There have been people living trans experiences as long as there have been people, dating back to the first people of Wisconsin and in indigenous times. And Ralph was an evidence of that. His story was shared all over the world. And unfortunately, he was known as the man-woman of Milwaukee, which is not, exactly the most courteous title. But he achieved international fame as a speaker afterwards, traveling on the vaudeville circuit, and lived quite a life. Unfortunately, the luck kind of ran out. He wound up marrying a man and died a woman in Chicago.
Mm. Let's fast forward now to August of 1961. Part of the tour and panel display tells the history of the Black Knight Brawl in Milwaukee. Can you talk a little bit about what happened here?
On August 5th, 1961, the Black Knight Tavern, which was one of the only bars in Milwaukee, gay or straight, to allow what was then called cross-dressing, was the target of a homophobic attack. Four servicemen were ordered on a drinking game dare to come to the Black Knight, which was a known gay bar, and really known probably more today, we would probably call it more of a queer space, because it was a favorite of the gender expansive community. Drag queens hung out there. What we would today call transgender people hung out there. It was a place that you could come as you are and you would be accepted and you would find community. You'd find other people like yourself in a safe place. And because the bar was on a police payoff system that kept many of Milwaukee's early gay bars safe and its customers protected. But unfortunately, these sailors came and started trouble. And Josie Carter, who was at that point a 23-year-old ex-Navy citizen, was enjoying cocktails with her husband, the bouncer. And, you know, this trouble broke out. The bouncer tried to break it up and the bartender jumped into the fight. And finally, Josie ended the fight by coming outside with two beer bottles and knocking the sailors unconscious. They left and vowed to come back, saying they were going to clean up the place and that, you know, they're going to be sorry, throwing some homophobic epithets out the window as they drove off. The bar owner wanted to close. He wanted Josie to leave. He wanted them to kind of evacuate for safety reasons. He knew that they could come back with guns, and he really didn't want to deal with, you know, military men tearing his bar apart. But Josie made a really historic choice that night. She said, no, I'm not leaving. We're not leaving. We're not closing, and we're not running. The time for running is over. We don't run from fights anymore. Enough is enough. And I understand her mindset. There was a lot going on in Milwaukee at that time. There had been a court-ordered raid program in Juneau Park, which was a favorite place for most of Milwaukee's gay men, that led to some pretty awful police brutality as they tried to make their quotas and arrest as many homosexuals as they could. People were arrested simply for walking down the sidewalk. There was really no criminal activity at all. And someone actually was beaten to death, which really terrified the gay elders of this time. And one of them shared with me in November 2015 that, you know, this was a moment where they had to decide, like, are we scared or are we going to be brave?
I was going to just jump in here to say that, Josie, you were able to get such vivid details about this, about this bar fight and about what happened. And that is very much a part of this history project. You're able to preserve that documentation.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time with Josie in the last years of her life, and she shared a lot of details. But the irony of this whole situation is that, you know, she inspired like the first uprising in Wisconsin history of LGBT people. She told people it is a choice to be the victim. It is a choice not to stand up against this. She said that night, there are more of us than there are of them. Why are we the ones running? And people had never heard that in their life. They were expected to be passive and docile and take the punches and take the abuse. And they were told their whole lives, if this is the life you choose, then this is what you deserve. And that night, everything changed.
Michael, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing this history.
Thank you.
That is Michael Takash, board chair of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. We talked with him about the project's 30th anniversary tour, bringing localized exhibits to Pride events around Wisconsin.
Information about the tour and its stops is at wislgbthistory.com. If you've seen the tour, if you've been part of a Pride rally in your own community, tell us about it. What was it like? Did it inspire you?
Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or leave us a voicemail. You can text us as well at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. And we'd love to see your photos.
If you like pie, and I do, there's some big news in Wisconsin. Big, delicious news.
As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a Wisconsin bakery won a USA Today expert and reader poll for the best pie in the United States.
The winner, Stockholm Pie and General Store in Stockholm on the Mississippi River.
Now, Rob, you are a big fan of desserts.
True.
Have you ever tried the pie there?
I have. I stayed in Stockholm on a trip a couple years back, so of course I tried the pie once or twice. I don't feel like I'm qualified to say if any pie is the best in the whole country, but I can say this is some good pie.
Do you have a favorite pie or another baked good in your community? Tell us about it. Call or text 888-642-0232, or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
I will happily go on a hard-hitting journalistic fact-finding trip to check out your recommendations.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.